As you know, the test comes this Thursday. You should have your English Bible with you. I think probably most of the questions, if you know the material, you could answer without the English Bible. But if you you can check on anything in it. If you have so poor a knowledge of a question that you have to hunt in the English Bible for it, you'd better not take time to do that or you won't get through. But simply to check on matters, it will be valuable to have it with you. And now we were speaking about F-interlaced duplicates, and we noticed these different types of, these three types of duplicates, and we were looking at this interlaced duplicate, and in particular, the story of the flood. And we noticed how the reason it's possible to divide it into duplicates is because there is a considerable amount of repetition of short phrases or short statements, often with a slight difference between them, and usually for the sake of vividness or of emphasis. And then that, of course, the argument that the flood is such an interlaced duplicate is expanded by claiming that the two sections into which it is divided are then each make a complete whole. We looked at that argument in relation with it. We looked at the argument from divine names and noticed that in at least two cases the divine name is in a verse that they put in the other section. And we noticed that as far as different styles is concerned, in order to try to make it the same phraseology as in other parts of P and J, in a number of cases they say that certain verses were inserted by the redactor. And then, of course, the claim is made that there are contradictions between the two, and that these contradictions show that there were two different stories. But we notice that the contradictions usually are the result of taking something out of one and putting it in the other, and then saying it didn't exist in the one. That there are actually no real contradictions in the story as it stands. But separating it that way, you can import contradictions into it. We do not have the problem here that we had in the case of the story of Joseph, of there being verbal contradictions, which we are sure can be explained if we knew all the facts. But we don't know all the facts. As for instance, what was the relation of Ishmaelites to Midian? It's altogether reasonable to think that that would be thoroughly understandable if we knew all the facts, but we just don't know them. We have no contradiction of that type in connection with the flood. And we notice that the Babylonian story of the flood has, while having definite differences from the biblical, has many remarkable similarities. And that these similarities are, having these remarkable similarities, that it has similarities with both the J story and the P story in so many, many regards that it's necessary, if you're going to divide the flood story, to divide the Babylonian story also, to say there was the same division that occurred in the two different countries at different periods with the same things in both stories simply is simply utterly unreasonable. Now, there's one more matter I want to point out about interlaced duplicate, and that is quite obviously that this method of division could easily be applied to many different literatures. That there are many different places where such a method, if it is valid, could be applied just as reasonably as it is alleged to be done in these instances. For that, William Henry Green, in his excellent book, The Higher Criticism of the Pentateuch, which though written nearly 100 years ago now, 70 years ago now, over 70, is still filled with remarkably excellent material. I don't know of any better book on the subject yet that has been written. His book is by no means out of date. Actually, it appeared shortly after the Wellhausen theory began to be well established. And the theory as taught today in most universities and theological seminaries is just about identical with what William Henry Green faced. And the evidence that he gives is just as valid today. But I would like to give you a very interesting illustration that he gives as to show how this method could be applied to other to other literature. If you will turn in your English Bible to the book of Luke, the 15th chapter. I will show you how he suggests that the same method could be applied to the story of the prodigal son. He says, suppose you apply the method that the critics apply to the flood story and these other stories, you could make an even better division in the story of the prodigal son than they do in the story of the flood. He says, let's suppose that we divide it into two documents, the A document and the B document. Now for the A document, we take verse 11, Luke 15, 11. A certain man had two sons. Then we take part of the first part of verse 12. And the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the portion of thy substance that falleth to me. Then verse 13, except for the middle section, and not many days after, the younger son gathered all together, last part of it, or later part of it, and there he wasted his substance with riotous living. The last part of 14, and he began to be in want. The last part of 16, and no man gave unto him. Verse 20, and he arose and came to his father, skipping a little bit, and he ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. And continuing, and the son said unto him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in thy sight, I am no more worthy to be called thy son. But the father said to his servants, bring forth quickly the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet. Verse 24, for this my son was dead and is alive again. And they began to be merry. 25, now his elder son was in the field, and as he came and drew nigh to the house, 28, he was angry and would not go in. And his father came out and entreated him. 29, but he answered and said to his father, lo, these many years do I serve thee, and I never transgressed a commandment of thine. And yet thou never gavest me a kid that I might make merry with my friends. But when this thy son came, which hath devoured thy living with harlots, thou killest for him the fatted calf. And he said unto him, son, thou art ever with me, and all that is mine is thine. But it was meet to make merry and be glad, for this thy brother was dead and is alive again, period. Because the last part of verse 32 belongs to the B document rather than the A document. Now take the portions that we did not read, and reading them consecutively, we get the B document with two or three very slight insertions. The first of those is to begin it, a certain man had two sons. That phrase was put in the A document. We can assume it also was in the B document. There was no point in repetition, so the redactor merely used it once. But continuing the last part of verse 12, and he divided unto them his living. Last part of 13, and then we insert one of them. He took his journey into a far country. Verse 14, and when he had spent all, there arose a mighty famine in that country. 15, and he went and joined himself to one of the citizens of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he would fain have been filled with the husks that the swine did eat. 17, but when he came to himself, he said, how many hired servants of my father's have bread enough and to spare, and I perish here with hunger. I will arise and go to my father, and will say unto him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in thy sight. I am no more worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thy hired servants. Last part of 20. But while he was yet afar off, his father saw him and was moved with compassion. 23. And said, bring the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and make merry. End of 24. He was lost and is found. 25. The latter part, speaking about the other son, says he heard music and dancing, and he called to him one of the servants and inquired what these things might be. And he said unto him, thy brother is come, and thy father hath killed the fatted calf because he hath received him safe and sound. End of 32. And he was lost and is found. Now thus the story of the prodigal son has been divided into two accounts, putting a little more than half in one, a little less than half in the other, and they read quite smoothly, as you see. Then he continues, as the critics do with the flood story and others. He says there are here two complete narratives, agreeing in some points and disagreeing in others. And each has its special characteristics. The only deficiencies are these two or three cases where the subject was, he put in parentheses, where the subject was not stated again. The only deficiencies, he says, are enclosed in parentheses and may be readily explained as omissions by the redactor in effecting the combination. A clause must be supplied at the beginning of B, a subject is wanting in 13B and 25B, and the verb said is wanting in verse 23. As these omissions occur exclusively in B, it may be inferred that the redactor placed A at the basis and incorporated B into it, with only such slight changes as were necessary to adapt it to this purpose. A and B agree there were two sons, one of whom received a portion of his father's property, and by his own fault was reduced to great destitution, in consequence of which he returned penitently to his father and addressed him in language which is nearly identical in both accounts. The father received him with great tenderness and demonstrations of joy, which attracted the attention of the other son. All this, as you notice, was in both accounts. But then he says the differences are quite as striking as the points of agreement. A distinguishes the sons as elder and younger. B makes no mention of their relative ages. In A, the younger obtained his portion by solicitation, and the father retained the remainder in his own possession. In B, the father divided his property between both of the sons on his own motion. In A, the prodigal remained in his father's neighborhood and reduced himself to penury by riotous living. In B, he went to a distant country and spent all his property, but there's no intimation that he indulged in unseemly excesses. It would rather appear that he was injudicious, and to crown his misfortunes, there occurred a severe famine. His fault seemed to have consisted in having gone so far away from his father and from the Holy Land, and in engaging in the unclean occupation of tending swine. In A, the destitution seems to have been chiefly want of clothing. In B, want of food. Hence, in A, the father directed the best robe and ring and shoes to be brought for him. In B, the fatted calf was killed. In B, the son came from a distant land, and the father saw him afar off. In A, he came from the neighborhood, and the father ran at once and fell on his neck and kissed him. In B, he'd been engaged in a menial occupation, and so bethought himself of his father's hired servants and asked to be made a servant himself. In A, he'd been living luxuriously, and while confessing his unworthiness, makes no request to be put on the footing of a servant. In A, the father speaks of his son as having been dead because of his profligate life. In B, of his having been lost because of his absence in a distant land. In A, but not in B, the other son was displeased at the reception given to the prodigal. This is a very interesting illustration of how you could take a story of the prodigal son, which reads straight through as it stands, and you can divide it, and you can get two complete stories. And then by noticing what's in one and isn't in the other, what's in the other and isn't in the one, you can find alleged contradiction between them. William Henry Green does the same thing with the story of the Good Samaritan. That is found in Luke 10, verses 20 to 37. A good illustration of how this could be done, but not quite as good as the one from the story of the prodigal son. Yes?
Are you going to be
not all, no, not all the contradictions, no. I think if you can look them up in Green, there are copies in the library for your own later purpose. But to get the general impression, I want you to have the specific illustrations in the Old Testament story, but not to remember all the specific illustrations here, but to notice how it can be done. Now the story of the Good Samaritan is in Luke 10, verses 29 to 37. And he gives an illustration here of dividing that into an A and a B section. I don't know, having done it in the previous one and shown you which verses or portions of verses go into one, whether I need to indicate that now, unless there's a big jump. You can notice in your English Bible, following it in Luke 10, just what's omitted in A, and then see how that is used in B. He says, but he, that is the lawyer, mentioned in verse 25, desiring to justify himself, said unto Jesus, and who is my neighbor? Jesus made answer and said, a certain man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and they beat him, leaving him half dead. And by chance a certain priest was going down that way, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. Then verse 33, But a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was, and came to him, and bound up his wounds, pouring on them oil and wine, and took care of him. 36, which of these, thinkest thou, proved neighbor unto him? And he said, he that showed mercy on him. Now reading the sections that were omitted from that, starting with the latter part of verse 30, and supplying the idea, a certain man, fell among robbers, which both stripped him and departed. 32, and in a like manner, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him pass by on the other side, and when he saw him, was moved with compassion, end of 34, and set him on his own beast, and brought him to an inn, 35, and on the morrow he took out 2 pence, and gave them to the host, and said, take care of him, and whatsoever thou spendest more, I, when I come again, will repay thee. And Jesus said unto him, as that fell among robbers, go and do thou likewise. Now, as you see, it isn't quite as complete as in the other case, but it is fairly complete. He says both these narratives are complete. Only a subject must be supplied in B, verse 30b, the omission of which was rendered necessary by its being combined with A. 3 has been substituted for 2 in A, verse 36, for a like reason. The redactor has tampered with the text and materially altered the sense in verse 32 from his desire to put the Levite on the same plane with the priest in verse 31, the language of which he has borrowed. The genuine text of B will be restored by omitting the insertions by R, which are enclosed in brackets here. He has likewise transposed a brief clause of B in verse 37b and added it to the end of verse 36. These changes naturally resulted from his making A the basis and modifying what he has inserted from B in accordance with it. Hence the necessity of making it appear that it was not the Levite but the Samaritan who befriended the injured traveler, and that Jesus spoke to the not to the traveler but to the lawyer. In all other respects, the original text of the two narratives remain unaltered. Both narratives agree that a man grievously abused by certain parties was treated with generous kindness by a stranger, and that Jesus deduced a practical lesson from it. But they differ materially in detail. A relates his story as a parable of Jesus in answer to a lawyer's question. B makes no mention of the lawyer or his question, but seems to be relating a real occurrence. The spirit of the two is quite different. A is anti-Jewish, B is pro-Jewish. In A, the aggressors are Jews, people of Jerusalem or Jericho or both, and a priest piteously leaves the sufferer to his fate, while it's a Samaritan with whom the Jews were in perpetual feud who took pity on him. In B, the aggressors are robbers, outlaws whose nationality is not defined, and it's the Levite who shows mercy. Both the maltreatment and the act of generosity are different. In A, the sufferer is beaten and half killed, and needs to have his wounds bound up and liniments applied, which is done by his benefactor on the spot. In B, he was stripped of all he had and left destitute, but no personal injury was inflicted. Accordingly, he was taken to an inn, and his wants there provided for at the expense of the Levite who befriended him. The lesson inculcated is different. In A, it is that the duty of loving one's neighbor is not limited to those of the same nation, nor annulled by national antipathy. In B, it is that he who has been befriended himself should befriend others. These two illustrations, I think, show very well how in many different places in almost any literature, especially where stories are given with enough vividness to make them live, thus there's a certain amount of repetition of a particular statement or particular phrase, it's not difficult to divide out and make two alleged stories. And once you do that, it's easy to say that what's contained in one is not in the other, and therefore is denied by the other. And a great part of the critical arguments rest on this sort of arguments for contradictions rest on this sort of argument from silence. Now, this sounds very extreme as you read it from those what he did with those, but it is not a bit more extreme than what you find the critical commentaries doing over and over in their dealing with the various duplicates in the scripture. Now, I think that's all the time we'd better spend on duplicates. I'm sorry we have so many missing over on this side of the room, so many empty seats. When we started, we had just as many over here, but they got filled up. And in fact, practically everybody got here in the last minute this morning. I wish you would try to everybody get here about 3 or 4 minutes earlier. so that we don't have people coming in late or coming in at the last minute. Now, I think it's well to go on then to our next consideration, which is the consideration of the fourth argument. I believe that would be Roman numeral 9, wouldn't it? I think I gave a separate Roman numeral to each of the four arguments. So Roman numeral 9 would be consideration of the fourth argument for partition, the argument from style. Number one, the importance of, or A rather, it'd be A, when it's the importance of this argument. Actually, our first argument could be considered as simply a part of this fourth argument. We put the first argument separate because it's where the criticism began and because it still is constantly referred to in particular points. But when you show the great fallacy to the first argument, the answer, one answer of the critic is, well, that's just one point of style among many different points of style. So that the first argument logically could be included in this, but still does deserve a separate place for its importance in the whole discussion. Now, the argument from style, then, is a very important argument. If you can actually show that you have material with different styles, such as the same writer could not have written, if you can actually show that, you have a very, very strong argument for partition. If, for instance, you could take Genesis 1 and list all the words contained in Genesis 1, and then take Genesis 2 and 3 and list all the words contained in them, and then omitting a few of the very common words that occur in both, if you could go through and take all the verses that use the words in Genesis 1 and put them in one document, all those using words in Genesis 2 or 3, put them in the other, and then could find continuous stories that read consecutively and presented in general the whole narrative, you would have a mighty, a strong argument. The first year that the seminary was established, I taught many hours in those days when we were getting started, and I spoke in chapel a great many times. And along in the middle of the year, I was asked by the Sunday School Times, which was then a rather widely read Christian periodical, to write a review for them of a certain book. Looking at the book, they asked me for a couple hundred words review. Looking at the book, I said, I don't think you want to put a couple hundred words on it. I said, it's not a book you would agree with at all. Well, they wrote back and said, if you have to give more, you can have up to 1,000. I write us a review. Well, I wrote them a review, and I found when it went through thoroughly, it took me about 1,500 words. And when I sent it to them, they said, certain couple of points you haven't dealt with fully, we should add a little on them. So in the end, it was about 2,000 words. I didn't mention this to the students or in any class in any way, but I wrote this review for them of this book. And the editor of the Sunday School Times ran it as a front page editorial without any name connected with it. So it's simply a title, I forget what he put in, and then named this book and discussed it on the front page of Time. As I walked down the street going to the church where we held our classes in those days, I passed a house that we had purchased as a dormitory for some of our students, and one of our first-year students was sitting on the front porch with the Sunday School Times in front of him, which he was reading. As he saw me come down the street, he hollered out, Dr. McCrae, I'm enjoying reading this article that you wrote. Well, I don't think he'd ever seen an article before that I had written, certainly not in the Sunday School Times. I don't think I'd ever had one. There was no name connected with it. But having heard me speak many times in chapel and heard me many times in class, he said he recognized my style immediately when he read that article on the front page of the Sunday School Times. I think that's a pretty good illustration of the fact that the argument from style is not something that can be simply swept aside as unimportant. If properly used, it is a very important argument. If it can be proved, it can go a long way towards establishing the critical theory. And therefore, it is vital that we examine it and to see how great an extent it can be proved. A friend of mine was crossing the ocean one time, the minister, and as he crossed, he got to talking with a professor from a liberal seminary who was on the same boat. And this, they got to discussing the Pentateuch, and this man said to him, well, if you read it in the Hebrew, he said, there's just as much difference between the J and P document as there is between reading Chaucer and modern English. Well, I think the man who said that just probably didn't know any Hebrew himself, because it's a ridiculous statement. There is not that sort of difference at all. The argument, as used by many of the critics, would almost make it two different dialects. And of course, when you speak of Chaucer and modern English, there's a big difference because the language has greatly changed. You take a letter that somebody wrote 100 years ago, and you would, I think, almost any letter written 100 years ago, you would immediately recognize the style as different from almost any letter written today. The general style of writing changes. But you take two matters written about the same period in the same language or in the same general dialect of that language, and it's quite different. I was at a party one time where they said, here is a little parlor game we're going to play. We're going to read you a selection, and you say whether it is taken from Shakespeare or from the Bible. And they had about 20 statements, one, two, or three sentences in each. They were all written in 16th century English. And some of them were quoted verbatim from parts of the book of Proverbs or parts of the song of the poetical books or the prophets. Some of them were quoted directly from some of the lesser known plays of Shakespeare. And although most of those present were people who had read the Bible a great deal, I doubt if there were many who recognized correctly in every case whether it was from the Bible or from Shakespeare. Those two great literatures are written in the style, the general style of English that was common at that period, which is very different from the style that is common to us today. Well, there is a difference then in the style of different periods, and of course the critic holds that the J document was written maybe a 10th century BC or a little later, and the P document about the 7th century. So you have about the same difference of period as there is between Chaucer, no, not King Chaucer, but between King James and us. But actually, to prove that they were from different periods would go a long way naturally to proving different documents in a case like this where they are interlaced. But it is a very important argument then, but an argument that must be used with great care. And so we want to note certain important facts about it. This was A, the importance of the argument. B, in the Pentateuch there is no solid basis for establishing a style of distinct writer's comment. In the Pentateuch there is no solid basis for establishing a style of different writers, comma, since no separate documents by these alleged writers have been preserved. Since no separate documents by these alleged writers have been preserved. Now that is a very important feature of the matter. If you have a book written by Mr. Fawcett and a book written by myself, and then you look at an article in the Beacon, which is unsigned, but which you have reason to believe was contributed by one or other of us, you could look at it and notice certain features which would suggest to you that Dr. Fawcett had written it rather than I. Or you could look at certain features which would suggest that I had written it rather than Dr. Fawcett. And you could go through the book by each of us to see the occurrence of these features. You would have a certain definite evidence example of the type of style which each of us would write. And then you might say, well, here's an article in the Beacon, an unsigned article in which the first paragraph appears to be very definitely by Dr. McRae, the second paragraph appears to be very definitely by Dr. Fawcett, but when you come to the third paragraph, we think Dr. McRae wrote the first three sentences and Dr. Fawcett wrote the next two, and they collaborated on the last sentence in it because it has some of the features of the style of Bull. Well, you would have a basis for alleging the features of the style of each one in the other book that we had written. Now, in the case of J and E and P, the documents are formed by the critics out of what's in the Pentateuch and put by themselves in that way, claiming to be characteristic styles of each. But we have no example of a complete work written by J or E or P. We have no solid basis for comparing and saying, this is the style of this one, this is the style of the other. These features are characteristic of the style of this book by J. These features of this book by E. These features are found in both and therefore cannot determine which was the author of the section. There's no solid basis for this division of style because we have nothing else by these men which can be definitely understood to be by a certain person as a basis of comparison. I think that's a very important point in connection with the argument from Scott. Now the third point, capital C. Evidence of the lack of solid basis, is provided by the history of criticism before the Wellhausen theory was presented. Evidence of the lack of solid basis is provided by the history of criticism before the Wellhausen theory was presented. Number one, as originally advanced, the proponents of the critical theory held that two documents could be distinct. You remember that Astruc and Eichhorn presented the view, and the critical scholars of their day quite generally followed them, that there are two distinct styles, the styles which they came to call the E style and the J style. That's number one. Number two, followers of this approach, that is the division, followers of the divisive approach, soon moved to a fragmentary theory, which alleged that a great number of short writings had gradually been assembled. Remember, there were many who advanced this fragmentary theory. Well, here you had so many short sections, how could you declare what was the style of each one? They did not feel there was a unified style in J and in P sufficient to prove them by different authors. They said there were many authors. Number three, the fragmentary theory was followed by the supplementary theory, which was dominant for half a century. The fragmentary theory was followed by the supplementary theory, which was dominant for half a century. It, like the original documentary theory, tells of two distinguishable styles, E and J. It, like the original development theory, held to two distinguishable styles, E and J. Number four, Ewald, we've discussed Ewald before, but in case you've forgotten, I'll spell his name again, E-W-A-L-D. Ewald's later view, the crystallization theory, would seem to give up any idea of a solid basis for different E and J styles. Avall's later view, the crystallization theory, would seem to give up any idea of a solid basis for different E and J styles. You remember the crystallization theory was, you had a short group of a short narrative, which was the basis of the Elohistic document. And then you had the J additions, which assume certain things in it. And then you had later E additions assuming certain things in the J parts, and then later certain J additions. Yes, sister? Yes, number four was Avall's later view, the crystallization theory, would seem to give up the idea of a solid basis for different E and J styles. Because he had the E, then J, and then E, and then J, and E and J crystallizing like this, that might be an attempt to get around the fact that there are parts of E that presuppose things told in J, parts of J that presuppose things told in E, but it certainly would not have two distinguishable styles. It would have many different writings. Then five. Number one. Long ways back. Number one, as originally advanced, proponents of the theory held that two documents could be distinguished. Then number five. Thus, during the period before Wellhausen, some scholars claimed to detect many sources with different styles, while the dominant theory held theories, I guess better say, held to two main styles, E and J. Thus, during the period before Wellhausen, some scholars claimed to detect many sources with different styles, while the dominant theory held to two main styles, E and J. The Eichhorn theory held two main styles, E and J. The supplementary theory held two main styles, E and J. So these were all evidences of our point C, which was that evidence of lack of solid basis is provided by the history of criticism before the Wellhausen theory was presented. So now we go on to D, capital D. Capital D, the Groth-Wellhausen theory completely overturns the previous idea as to. The Groth-Wellhausen theory completely overturns the previous idea as to two recognizable styles. Now this, I think, is very important. Number one, Hupfeld in 1853 suggested dividing E into two sources, comma. Hupfeld in 1853 suggested dividing E into two sources, comma, one of which was so similar to J as to be very difficult to distinguish from it. One of which was so similar to J as to be very difficult to distinguish from it. You remember Hupfeld called these E1 and E2. He thought the order of writing was E1, E2, J, and then D. But he said that E1 was utterly different style from J. E2, which had been considered by all the followers of Eichhorn and by all of the holders of the supplementary theory to be readily distinguishable from J, part of the E document, he held with so much like J, you could hardly distinguish him by style, mostly only by the divine name. Number two, Groth, Kuhnen, and Wellhausen accepted this division promise. Accepted this division, comma, but the name of E1 came to be changed first to Q. That's what Wellhausen used, was Q, remember, capital Q. Then to P, comma, with E2 designated simply as E, comma. With E2 designated simply as E, comma. And the theory as to the order of writing was changed to J, E, D, P. With E2 designated simply as E, and the theory as to the order of writing was changed to J, E, D, P. Yes? The whole thing? Number two, Groff, Kuhn, and Wellhausen accepted this division, comma, but the name of E1 came to be changed, comma, first to Q, comma, then to P, comma, with E2 designated simply as E, and the theory as to the order of writing changed to J, E, D, P. That was it.
I thought you said prior to the list there were basically two divisions, two styles of J and E. Right.
Previous to Wellhausen.
Yes. Right. And then they divided E into two parts. One remains E, the other you can call P. Now, how about D?
Well, yes. Thank you for mentioning that. We have not said a great deal about D as yet. But in our presentation of the second of these two movements, one is the movement for partition, the other one is the movement for development, the two which were united by Groff and Wellhausen. In our discussion of that, we mentioned that Di Vecchi claimed to prove, and most critical scholars accepted it after that time, 150 years ago, that the book of Deuteronomy was in the main written at the time of Josiah. And that, you see, the book of Deuteronomy then, in the main, they call D. And we are, there are certain sections in Kings and a very little in the earlier book that they say is Deuteronomy. But in the main, what they call D is the greater part of the book of Deuteronomy. And we'll try to look at that specifically by itself. But I'm merely mentioning its place in the order as a theory of salvation at this point. Mr. Brackney, did you have a question? All right. Thank you. Then, number three. Number three, thus passages that for half a century were considered to be part of a document very different in style from J. I should say, thus passages that for more than half a century were considered to be part of a document very different in style from J, are now thought to be part of a document very different in style from J, are now thought to be part of a document that is said to be so similar to J as to be very. To be part of a document that is said to be so similar to J as to be very difficult to distinguish from it, comma. But that is said to be so different from P as to be easily distinguished from it. As to be very difficult to distinguish from it, comma, but that is said to be so different from P as to be easily distinguished from it. Now there are two facts in connection with this point just mentioned that are important enough, I think, to mention under it as small a and small b. Small a, outside of Genesis, comma, outside of Genesis, comma, and sometimes even in Genesis, comma. Critics in places simply label passages as J-E instead of trying to differentiate. Outside of Genesis, and sometimes even in Genesis. Present day critics simply label certain passages as J-E, capital J, capital E, instead of trying to differentiate. Now I think that's very interesting. They're showing how they think the style of J and E is so similar you can't separate them and just call this all J-E, when before all that they call E, they thought was so utterly different from J that it went with what they now call P. Small b. Small b, there is great difference of opinion among critics as to which passages are J and which are E. There is great difference of opinion among critics as to which passages are J and which are E. Now that is something that is noticeable once you compare any two or three books on the critical theory. They agree very closely as to what is P. It is comparatively seldom that you find one critic saying something is P and another critic saying it is. But as to J and E, while there are certain sections which all critics agree are J, certain critics which they are sections which they all agree are E. There are many sections which you will find a number of critics say are J and a number say are E. There are many chapters in Genesis which some critics, which most of the critics say are made up of J and E, and which most of them divide. But the division is often very different. You have half a verse to J, and then a whole verse to E, and then another verse to J, and three verses to E, and three words to J, and the differences are very great. As to J and E, but not as to P. And so I think this is a big argument against the validity of the idea that you have three distinct styles, or as originally held, especially as originally held, two distinct styles. Now capital E, all this was on capital D. Now capital E is the alleged criteria are not carried through consistently. The alleged criteria are not carried through consistently. According to the critical theory, one of the distinctive features of the P document is the material in Leviticus, the greater part of which they give to P, which has all this ceremonial law about what animals are clean and what animals are unclean and so on. And yet in the story of the flood, they say that the P document has him bringing two of every kind into the ark, while they say the J document has him bring in seven pairs of each of the clean beasts and far less of each of the unclean beasts. That is the distinction between clean and unclean, which is so important a part of the ceremonial law, all of which in Leviticus is given to P. This clean and unclean idea they put into J in the flood. And then they find the word male and female. You have male and female in Genesis 1, man and his wife in Genesis 2, but in the flood story, in trying to make two distinct stories, they have sections where one of these phrases occurs in a sentence that they say belongs to the other document, so they say these words were changed by a redactor. It's not carried through consistently. The words 40 days are part of the J document in the flood story, but in one case they occur in the middle of a verse they put in P, and they say they were inserted there by a redactor. Even in the case of the divine names, it's not carried through consistently. There are cases where the e-document has the name Jehovah. There are cases where the J-document has the name Elohim. In the P-document, you don't have the name of God occurring so frequently. In the P-document is largely statistics, enumerations, and so on. You have Elohim all through Genesis 1 in the P-document. But even in the P-document, there are one or two cases where the name Jehovah occurs and where they say it has been put in by a redactor. Now, if you divide, can make a clear division, two different types of style, that's one thing. But then if you have to say, well, in this case, the redactors put a P word in that. Here, the redactors put in the J word. You greatly reduce the logical strength of the argument. Now, we're ready for point F, but I think we better close until tomorrow. And please try to be here more promptly tomorrow than today.